You're listening to the Overeaters Anonymous Mid-Peninsula podcast. Overeaters Anonymous is a fellowship of individuals who, through shared experience, strength, and hope, are recovering from compulsive overeating. Our primary purpose is to abstain from compulsive eating and compulsive food behaviors and to carry the message of recovery through the 12 steps of OA to those who still suffer. For more information, please visit oamidpeninsula.org.
I'm Patrick, food addict, bulimic, I already said I'm in 30 years. This time around, it's 9 years. God's granted me peace, and he's taken the 96 pounds, which I hope he keeps. I always like to say at the start of my meeting, experience is a hard teacher. She gave me the test first and the lesson afterwards. So I always failed the test. I always had to come and learn the hard way, the slow way, the painful way. But that's just the way it's been. In recovery, I've learned about mindlessness. And the reason I talk about mindlessness, like I'll give you an example. I'm driving out of my driveway in a mindless state, and I turn left onto my street, which is what I do 90%+ of the time. It's pretty normal. However, I suddenly realize I was supposed to do a right turn because of a particular errand. And so to me, this is a bit of mindlessness. And the reason I concern myself about mindlessness is I think when I was in relapse, there was a lot of mindlessness going on. It's a wonder I didn't get killed somehow. I was very focused on what the next food was going to be, but I was still mindless. I wasn't paying attention. And so as an addict, I mean, it wasn't the end of the world. I didn't hurt anybody. It wasn't the end of the world. But as an addict, mindlessness is dangerous and it has consequences. So in recovery, my job is to not slip into that mindless behavior. I read two things in the morning when I get started, page 86 and 98. So page 86, basically step 11, but I read it for a specific reason. It reminds me to not to slip into worry, remorse, and morbid reflection. And that's really important because those are things I was also in relapse, and I don't want to be in those things. They're very negative. They take a lot of energy. When I first read that, I was like, oh my God, somebody's got my biography in here. Those are the three feelings I always felt. But anyway, so one of my favorite journalists and poet, Carl Sandburg, used to write, civilizations have been lost because they forgot from where they came, right? Well, as an addict, I need to be aware of who I am and what I am when I do things. When I go out in the world, and it's not that I want to avoid life, mind you, but I do want to be aware of reality, particularly when I go into the grocery store or Dunkin' or Starbucks or somewhere like that, where all that dessert stuff is kept under glass. And by the way, dessert spelled backwards is stressed. I always like to play with words. And page 101 in the big book, it tells me, so our rule is not to avoid places we're drinking if we have a legitimate reason. That's the clincher. And it says, in our belief, any scheme combating alcoholism, proposing to shield the sick man from temptation is doomed to fail. What is it they say? Rather than carpeting the world, I wear slippers, right? So I can't make the world perfect and get rid of all the desserts or whatever it is that bothers me. When I do the steps, I will be given neutrality. That is promised in my 9th step promises, So my last relapse, and I won't go too much into this, but there's a couple of details I want to make. I started 15 years ago. I was walking in Greenwich Village with four other, what I call civilians. And believe it or not, there are civilians in the world. There are people that are not addicted to food, not addicted to alcohol, not addicted to drugs. There are a couple of people on the planet that are addicts, but they were like, oh my God, let's go in here. And it was the Bleecker Street Bakery, And so I walked through that threshold kind of in a mindless state. I wasn't thinking about things, And yet in the back, way in the deep back of my mind, I was thinking, should I wait outside? But that quickly passed. And then I saw this free stuff, and I know we can't mention food. So just imagine there was free stuff on the countertop. And it was like, oh my God, something free in New York. I'm going to pass out. And then amnesia sunk in. Then amnesia occurred. And I do have amnesia. I forget the pain and sorrow and misery that this thing causes me over the lust and the sex of what's sitting in front of me. And so I went for this thing, and I told myself the lie. I'll start the diet tomorrow, right? Tomorrow. Tomorrow never comes. So I had this one thing, but I believed in the fantasy that I told myself. And fantasy is a really trouble. It's a bad character defect that I have. It's one of my major character defects, self-pity and fantasy. And, you know, I read in the back of the big book, the last story, How to Handle Sobriety, the last story in the back of the big book, the last paragraph of that last story is very important to me. And I think it's so important. I just want to quickly read it because it just says a lot. And for me, anyway, it says, above all, we reject fantasizing and accept reality. The more I drank, the more I fantasized everything. I imagined getting even for hurts and rejections. In my mind's eye, I played and replayed the scenes in which I was plucked magically from the bar where I stood nursing a drink and was instantly exalted to some position of power and prestige. I lived in a dream eating poison. I dreamed that I'd have six-pack abs and somehow be able to eat this stuff. You know, I used to open my refrigerator looking for love and six-pack abs and found neither of those. So, and it further says in this thing, AA led me gently from this fantasizing to embrace reality with open arms. And I found it beautiful, for at last I was at peace with myself, with others, and with God. So fantasy and reality, when I wake up in the morning, fantasy or reality, which one do I choose today? And to me, for me, that's a very important thing, because I used to have like a calling card, and my calling card, when I handed it to you, was pity me. So I liked self-pity and getting pity from others. And it was like, kind of like a character in, you know, Tennessee Williams play, like, you know, Blanche DuBois in Streetcar says, I depend on the kindness of strangers. Well, I depended on the pity of strangers. And so I don't want to do that anymore, because that's all old behavior. And the other thing is, you know, Karen R. wrote a great story in the big book called Crossing the River Denial. And in it, on page 334, she talks about the greatest obsession is to have her alcohol and control it at the same time. And that was my greatest obsession, you know, when I was eating, is I wanted to have this stuff and somehow become thin and control it. And that's another delusion that I practice regularly in my disease. But so I just had the one thing that night. And the next, you know, and everything seemed calm, and I got away with it. Yeah, Patrick got away with it. Yeah, I got away with this. But the next morning, I convinced myself to have I don't want to say the word, so bothered. But what you have with eggs, you know, put eggs on top of it. And unfortunately began another journey, you know, into the shadows of my food addiction and bulimia. And, you know, by the way, the bakery showed that item to be free, but guess what? There was a price tag. There was a big price tag. 5 years in relapse, over 100-pound gain, you know, endless bulimia, and the worst was my spiritual life went south, and that was really difficult. And so, my friend, who's like me, big, and he's either dieting or binging. That's his life, and I had a lot of that life too. But he died suddenly of a heart attack, and it really bothered me and it upset me. And at that time, I thought, oh my God, I should make a decision, go back to OA, right? And yet I made the decision, but I didn't do the action. And with a decision, you need action, otherwise nothing. So so I spent the next 7 months trying to convince myself to go away. And finally I did. I was off on a Saturday morning. I drove my car to this meeting, OA meeting, a big book actually. And somehow I kind of like woke out of a fog in front of a fast food drive-through place. And I didn't make the meeting, I swear to God. And that happened 3 weeks in a row. And finally, the fourth week, I make it there. I park the car, I'm ready to go in. And all of a sudden, I'm negotiating the universe according to Patrick. And that was, I'm not going to do how it's a pain in the ass. I'm not going to do a sponsor pain in the and I'm not going to, certainly not going to do the action steps, but I can do step 1, 2, and 3 and get rid of that. And as I walk in, I was a little late. And they were reading out of this page, and it blew my mind. Page 325, it's called A Student of Life. And the girl is not going to to AA meeting, so she's struggling with alcohol, obviously. But her friend is recovering AA, and he says, why don't you go? And she goes, I don't want. Why don't you go? He wouldn't take no for an answer. Why don't you go? Because I'm not sure I'm done drinking yet. And he said, you hit bottom when you stop digging. And so he took her to a meeting and things did work out. But this made the hair in the back of my head stand out. This is just what I was going over, rehearsing, coming into the meeting, how I wouldn't do this, wouldn't do that. And God spoke to me through that situation. And I had an immediate spiritual experience. So I'm very grateful for that because it's a very wonderful thing to do. And, you know, on page 87, the big book says, you know, it talks about, you can still hear me, right? Good. Because it's raining so loud that I can barely hear anything. It's like, you know, biblical rain here in New Jersey. but being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it's probable that we're not going to be inspired all the time. We might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. Nevertheless, we find our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely on that. I mean, isn't that beautiful? I think that's beautiful. And I love it. But you know, there is something that doesn't like that. My ego doesn't like that. My disease doesn't like that. My red light foods don't like that. They hate that statement. They don't want the spiritual world. They will block me off from that. You know, I used to think I had like three defenses with this disease, you know. One was a willpower, self-knowledge, and fear was the third one. And while those things did work, you know, they did work, but they also failed me. And as time went by, they failed me more and more, you know? And so, but by doing the steps in OA helped me realize there's a fourth defense, the spiritual defense. You know, it's funny. I came into the How Rooms 30 years ago, and they said, no flour, no wheat, no sugar. And I said, no way. I mean, you just described my entire food pyramid. And so, and then they handed me this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, what? Are you kidding me? What do I have to do with a bunch of drugs? You know, I mean, I don't know. You know, maybe the Betty Ford Clinic book would have made sense to me, but not some big book. But, you know, it's funny. Fellowship was very important. It helped give me the courage to go into that book, do the steps. And when I did the steps, I was amazed to find this book was all about me. Oh my God. And, you know, it's funny. When I was young, I didn't get along very good with my father. He was a stranger to me and I was very uncomfortable. We never kissed or hugged or anything. He was kind of like the authoritarian warden kind of person. And he was also a periodic drunk who never went to AA, by the way. And when he showed up drunk, he would rage all over us. And I was very afraid of him. I wet my bed till I was 8 years old out of fear. I didn't know. And, you know, some nights he would get home and say, if anybody's awake up there, I'm going to take them to Carvel. And, of course, we'd run down and be awake. But he also would be rage sometimes. So it was very scary and unpredictable. And so I assumed he didn't love me. And I know the world. I am right. He doesn't love me. He doesn't care. And, you know, when I was 18 and the day I was leaving for college, he was in the kitchen with me. And he cried when I was leaving. And I was shocked. I was completely shocked that the world I had created or I thought I knew what was my reality was wrong, dead wrong. I made the wrong assumptions. And so I don't ever just assume or believe everything my mind tells me, you know. This is why I've learned not to trust my mind, you know, because it's linked to the fantasy world. And that's where the danger comes in. You know, I can bend the truth and to suit or justify my own prejudices. This is why I always say when I'm in my head, I'm behind enemy lines, right? Because it's bad news in there. It's a minefield through there. I don't like walking through there. And it's created a lot of heartache and trouble doing so. But you see, what's in my head becomes what I am. But I am more than a food-obsessed zombie. You know, that's not me. And so I've also learned to separate my emotions from my disease. A very important lesson I learned in the big book, page 450, he lived only to drink. What was really important that he had a lifelong resentment against his mother was cruel to him. And he says, but I was able to realize that the bonfire of resentment and rage was beckoning me to pick up a drink and plunge to my death. Then I realized that I had to separate my sobriety from everything else in my life. No matter what happens, I couldn't drink. So you know, the tides of life flow endlessly, up and down, bad, good. These things all happen. But I need to separate my emotions from my disease, because that used to take me out sometimes. You know, when I had emotions, I ran to the bakery because I can't handle these emotions. My life has been driven, it's been motorized by running from my feelings, and I don't like feelings. So this is an important lesson to me. I know it sounds a little bit like a formula for schizophrenia, but you know, but it does work for me anyway. So people ask me, how am I doing? 15? Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Sandy. People ask me, how's it going? I say, I'm good in spite of the world. They say, what? But that's true, because the world, not only the media and the internet world, but my world of people close to me, family, friends, and all that, these things could take me out also. So they, you know, the world is a troublesome place, and it's kind of upside down a lot. But I no longer have to be upside down, thanks to this resource and this program. I can be okay. So the spiritual principles, what are they anyway? Well, they're the steps, right? And so particularly step 11, I find very important. Not step 10, but step 11, even though I do both, by the way, because they're both living steps. All three living steps, 10, 11, and 12. But step 11, because I want to improve my conscious contact with God. This is the most important relationship I'm going to have. And by doing this, I can maintain a spiritual relationship, or I can be prepared for a spiritual awakening by improving that, you know? So that's really important. Somebody asked me which steps are spiritual. Well, you know, the consensus is 4, 5, and 9, right? And I concur with that. However, I feel if I'm working any step honestly and from the heart, and true, I am on the threshold of revelation, because a spiritual event can occur at any time. And so it's very important how honest I do that step. And so the question then asked is, what is a spiritual, you know, what is a spiritual awakening? What the heck is that? Well, how about magic? I know that sounds silly, but, you know, something in me changed. I want to help others. I no longer want to seek revenge or play resentments endlessly in my head. Remember what I said: when I'm in my head, I'm behind an enemy line. So I don't want to be there anymore. To me, a spiritual awakening is magic. And I'm thinking about the magic that's described on page 84, the ninth step promises. And I just got to read them, because I think it's important. This is magic to me. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish thing and gain interest in our fellow and our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think so. Yes. To me, you know, magic. That's what I say. You know, now in my spiritual life, I have three principles that I follow, three little rules in order for me to walk in this crazy world and somehow maintain a spiritual life. And that is, one, I am independent of opinions. What you think and say about me is none of my business. Number two, when I pray unconditionally, because to me, a conditional prayer is a demand. That's not a prayer at all. So when I pray unconditionally, and I'm not so arrogant as to expect results. What I want tonight, God may give me a year from now. God has a different timeline. So I have to be patient and just be sincere and do that. And number three is, don't control others. Don't control others. Otherwise, I'm like that guy like the Wizard of Oz behind the screen, pulling all the things and trying to control everybody's life. And I'm, you know, crazy doing that, you see. So by practicing the 12 steps, it's important, but particularly the living steps. steps, 10, 11, and 12, so I can maintain my spiritual life or even have a spiritual awakening if I still haven't had that yet. That will come. So I go to meetings basically to do service, you see. But I used to go to meetings to be entertained. I want the biggest, brightest, biggest, yay, yay, yay meeting. And that's not good because sooner or later, I'm going to find an excuse to stay home. But as a service, that's different. I now have a service to that meeting, and I will go no matter how I feel. And so that's really an important thing. And what about the biggest question yet? The biggest question is, do I practice these principles in all my affairs? Because that's what it said.
1 minute left.
Okay, thank you. And so I have a little quick joke that I'm going to tell. Two AA guys outside of an AA meeting in the hall, and one's a sponsee, one's a sponsor. The sponsee says to the sponsor, I can't practice these principles in all my affairs. And the sponsor says, well, maybe you're having too many affairs. But anyway, the point is, can I practice the principles in the real world? I can do it in a meeting, but can I do it at home? And that's really important, you know, that I do that. That's really the challenger. Now, I want to say this following statement. It's very important. The illness of compulsion is indirectness. I'm going to say it again. The illness of compulsion is indirectness. If I'm indirect, I'm heading toward my disease because there's a dishonesty in being indirect. And so that's important. Now, I'm going to wrap up because I know I'm out of time. The second reading, page 98 in the middle, is that, you know, the alcohol may come to rely upon us rather than God. And he says he has to, but that's nonsense. We learn job, no job, wife or no wife. We simply cannot depend on people ahead of God. So I can't depend on my sponsor. I mean, I talk to them and send readings and writings and stuff and get feedback, but I can't depend on them. That's codependence. And that's just another character defect. So, so I don't want to be disillusioned and play the victim anymore. I used to be poor me, poor Patrick, poor Patrick, poor Patrick, a milkshake, right? Self-pity always got me into the food. I mean, pity parties don't serve crudité. They serve flour, wheat, and sugar. It's not a good place to go. I can't afford it anymore. So let me just wrap up. I'm the architect of most of my problems, you see. So I've learned that through doing this. Now, Mother Teresa used to ask the question, do you want to be happy? Be compassionate, right? Faith leads to love, which leads to service. And, you know, I came to program 30 years ago and I was a big shot, knew it all, but I worked myself all the way up to servant. And I'm going to close now with my favorite Scottish theologian, Karl Bard, saying, and by the way, I saw this, his statement plagiarized in one of the stories in the back of the big book, Safe Haven, it's called. But I love this statement. It says, I can't go back and make a brand new start, but I can start right now and make a brand new end. Thank you and God bless you.